Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Secretary General says that he is deeply saddened by the tragic loss of life in the Itaewon district of Seoul in the Republic of Korea over the weekend, in which 154 people died and more than 130 were injured. There are fears that the death toll due to the stampede in the crowded entertainment district could rise. Antonio Guterres expressed his sincere condolences to the families of the victims, many of whom were teenagers and people in their 20s, as well as to the government and people of South Korea. An estimated 100,000 people had gathered in Itaewon for the country's biggest Halloween festivities since the COVID-19 pandemic began, and strict rules on gatherings were enforced. On Monday, the country's Prime Minister, Han Duck-soo, announced a thorough investigation into the stampede, and President Yoon Suk-yeol declared a day of national mourning. The outlook for global markets has worsened in recent months, with job vacancies and job growth likely to decline significantly in the final quarter of 2022, according to a new report by the International Labour Organization, or ILO. The 10th edition of the Monitor on the World of Work finds that rising inflation is causing real wages to fall in many countries. This comes on top of significant declines in income during the COVID-19 crisis, which affected low-income groups the most in many countries. The report also finds that labour market inequalities are likely to increase, contributing to a continued divergence between developed and developing economies. Gilbert Hangbo, ILO Director General, says that a set of multiple and overlapping crises, compounded by the war in Ukraine, are having a deep impact on the world of work.
Altogether, this is undoubtedly a grim global picture, but we are not helpless. If we take the right steps, we can shape what happens next. And to do this, our policy choices need to be integrated, balanced, and comprehensive, and take into account sectoral, labor market, and social factors, as well as the financial factors.
And finally, many oil and gas companies are increasing their efforts to tackle methane, one of the biggest and most solvable contributors to the climate crisis. But more needs to be done, according to a report launched on Monday at a major gathering of the industry. The report, an Eye on Methane, International Methane Emissions Observatory 2022, was presented by the UN Environment Programme, or UNEP, in Abu Dhabi. It shows that over 80 oil and gas companies across the world have committed to measuring and reducing their methane emissions. Inga Andersen, Executive Director of UNEP, said that cutting methane emissions is the fastest way to tackle climate change in the short term, as it remains in the atmosphere for far fewer years than carbon dioxide. Despite the relative progress, corporations need to move faster and harder, she urged. Nikki Chadwick, UN News.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, a 1995 Washington Post story led with a macabre account from the widow of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner about how when her husband's bloody shirt was held up in court, his accused killer, Mumia Abu-Jamal, turned in his chair and smiled at her. It was an evocatively sinister report, which the paper printed, untroubled by the fact that court records showed that Abu-Jamal wasn't in court when the shirt was displayed. ABC's investigative news show 2020 used all the techniques for their big 1998 piece on the conviction of Abu-Jamal for Faulkner's killing, stating prosecution claims as facts, even when they were disputed by some of the prosecution's own witnesses, stressing how a defense witness admitted being intoxicated while omitting that prosecution witnesses said the same thing. At one point, actor and activist Ed Asner was quoted saying no ballistic tests were done, which is pretty stupid, but then host ABC Sam Donaldson's voiceover cut him off saying, but ballistic tests were done, referring to tests that suggested that the bullet that killed Faulkner might have been the same caliber as Abu Jamal's gun, but refraining from noting that tests had not, in fact, been done to determine whether that gun had fired the bullet or whether that gun had been fired at all or if there were gunpowder residues on Abu Jamal's hands. No one paying attention was surprised when it was revealed that in a letter asking permission from the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections to interview Abu Jamal, a request that was denied, ABC noted that, quote, we are currently working in conjunction with Maureen Faulkner and the Philadelphia Fraternal Order of Police. That kind of overt, proud of it bias has shaped coverage of Mumia Abu Jamal's case from the outset, and current mentions suggest that little has changed. Elite media will report without question a right-wing Senate candidate's tossed-off reference to Mumia as the face of unrepentant criminality, while out of the other side of their mouths, respectfully noting how Brown University is acquiring the papers of Mumia as he's an acknowledged representative of the serious problem of mass incarceration and his communications are deemed historically important. Meanwhile, Mumia's chances for a new trial based on significant new evidence were shot down summarily this week. But a glance at national media coverage as we tape on October 27th would tell you, well, nothing about that. Counterspin got an update and a reminder of the real life versus the media story of Mumia Abu Jamal from Noel Hanrahan, legal director at Prison Radio. That's coming up, but first a quick look back at some recent media. After January 6, 2021, Amazon issued a righteous declaration that they would stop contributing to members of Congress who were part of a, quote, unacceptable attempt to undermine a legitimate democratic process, close quote. But in September 2022, as Popular Information reported, the Amazon PAC donated $17,500 to nine members of the House whose conduct they had previously deemed unacceptable. Amazon had pledged to discuss concerns directly with members who voted to overturn the election and evaluate their responses before donating again. There is zero indication that any conversations occurred, and none of the nine members who received donations from Amazon last month has expressed any regret for their vote on January 6th. In response to Popular Information's request for comment, Amazon sent a statement saying, oh my gosh, you fell for that? Oh, no, wait, they sent a statement saying, quote, when we announced shortly after the attack on the Capitol in January 2021 that we would suspend donations to members of Congress who voted against certifying the results of the 2020 U.S. presidential election, it was not intended to be permanent. It's been more than 21 months since that suspension, and like a number of companies, we've resumed giving to some members, close quote. Ah, the old 21 months clause. As Popular Information notes, ending the suspension of donations after 21 months is convenient, given that a congressional campaign cycle is 24 months and the need for cash increases as Election Day approaches. So, resuming donations to candidates that voted to overturn the 2020 election about 6 weeks before this Election Day means there was no practical impact to Amazon's suspension. And October 26th marked 1 year since President Biden nominated Gigi Sohn to the Federal Communications Commission. Since then, as the group Free Press notes, the FCC has remained deadlocked 2-2 on critical decisions about how phone, cable, and broadcast companies conduct their deeply influential business, while those deep-pocketed companies fight tooth and nail to keep Sohn, an actual public interest advocate, out of the job of advocating for the public interest. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has a chance to call an important vote on this as soon as Congress returns. As Free Press notes, if the Senate genuinely wants to improve the lives of everyone who uses the Internet or cell phones or TV or radio, confirming Gigi Sohn before the clock runs out would be a simple and meaningful step. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. TV snake oil salesman and Republican Pennsylvania candidate Mehmet Oz began a recent debate with opponent John Fetterman with reference to Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Fetterman, Oz claimed, quote, has been trying to get as many murderers convicted and sentenced to life in prison out of jail as possible, including people who are similar to the man who murdered her husband, close quote. You could live in a cave and understand what Oz was trying to do there, but not everyone may recognize the particular dog whistle that is the reference to Mumia Abu-Jamal, convicted of fatally shooting Daniel Faulkner in 1983. That was the conviction. Mumia Abu-Jamal's conviction turned importantly on unreliable and conflicting testimony. It was significant that in taking up the case, elite news media went along for the ride and sometimes drove the car, encouraging acceptance, for instance, of the fact that, though the guard assigned to Mumia immediately after his arrest reported, quote, the Negro male made no statements, close quote, more to be believed was the other officer who subsequently came forward to say that actually from his hospital bed, Mumia had declared, quote, I shot the motherfucker and I hope he dies, close quote. Neither witness recantations or shifting accounts or evidence of jury purging in Mumia's case, nor the ever-expanding evidence of the terrible harms and injustices of the U.S. prison system generally, seem to be enough to shake some media from their investment in the narrative of the, quote, convicted cop killer, close quote, and the need to keep him not just behind bars, but also to keep him and people similar to him quiet, to keep their voices and their lives out of public conversation and consideration. Noelle Hanrahan is legal director at Prison Radio, where Mumia Abu-Jamal is lead correspondent. She joins us now by phone from Pennsylvania. Welcome back to Counterspin, Noelle Hanrahan.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we can fill in context as we go, but please go ahead and start with what's uppermost. What is the latest legal development here?
When a defendant is trying to overturn their conviction, and Mumia has been in for 42 years, when they protest their innocence, they have to go to the local trial court. That, in Philadelphia, is the common pleas court. Mumia had fantastic, new, critical evidence that was just discovered 2 years ago. There was a note in the prosecutor's files that said, where was my money, from one of the key defendants? And this happened right after the trial, implying that he was paid for his testimony. There were also notes saying that the other key witness, their cases were being tracked, and that none of the outstanding charges pending against this witness were ever prosecuted. The most dramatic evidence was evidence of taking blacks off of the jury and marks on the prosecutor's notes about the racial composition of the jury and also what was good and bad about which jury was selected, which juror, a white or a black juror. These were critical documents that many other people have gotten relief on. the jury notes are called the Batson claims, the U.S. constitutional claim. The suppression of evidence by the prosecution, burying evidence for 40 years, is called a Brady claim. These have gotten relief from many other defendants. So now, 42 years later, Mumia Abu-Jamal was before Judge Lucretia Clemens in the Commons Police Court, and yesterday she denied all of his claims. She denied them procedurally. She refused to look at the merits of the body of evidence, and specifically this new evidence, and she denied it based on time bar, waiver, due diligence. And it's just like, it's the Post-Conviction Relief Act, which is there only to deny inmates access to the courts. So I was Mumia's producer. I've worked on Mumia with his books, many of his books, including his latest trilogy, Murder Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, and Manifest Destiny. We published those materials about 5 years ago. I went to law school. I passed the bar in Pennsylvania. And it's unbelievable to see the level of stiff-arming accountability to the Frank Rizzo, Ed Rendell, Ron Castile era of literal torture of defendants and witnesses, like literally torture, not figuratively, literally. Think John Birch in
right.
Chicago.
Right.
Like, think of the types of torture that have happened. That is typically what happened in the cases that I now investigate, innocence cases, prosecutorial misconduct cases, cases where this kind of information is available to these judges. I'll give you one clear example. One of the key witnesses, Robert Chobert. He was a cab driver driving without a license. He was on probation. He had thrown a Molotov cocktail into a school for pay. None of that material was before the jury. There were pictures. He said he was right behind the police car and saw yesterday the district attorney in this case, Grady Gravino, on the other side, said Robert Chobert looked up from his cab and saw Mumia shoot the officer. There are pictures that just came out a few years ago from the Philadelphia Bulletin that prove, that were taken 10 minutes after the shooting, that prove that Robert Chobert wasn't there. His cab was not behind the police car. Those photographs, the Polakoff photos, were denied into evidence. They were prevented from being put into the record. So we have Robert Chobert being presumed to be this, like, amazing witness with no problems. Literally, the photos prove he wasn't there. And nobody was able to be told to the jury that he was on probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail into a school for pay. He came back to McGill and asked, could he get his cab driver's license reinstated? No promise, he said. McGill said there was no promise of favoritism. Then we discovered 2 years ago his note in the prosecutor's files. Where is my money for testifying? So the context, right? So that's zooming in right now on what happened in court. The context, the things that haven't been given to the court before that haven't been considered today. We have a court reporter, Terry Moore Carter, saying in front of another judge, Richard Klein, that Albert Szabo said, I'm going to help them fry the N-word.
Hmm.
He said this in the first week of the trial.
Yeah.
So this is America.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the kind of trial that Mumia Abu-Jamal had, where his original trial judge, Albert, I'm going to help them fry the N-word, Szabo, presided. And so we have a judge now who is saying, none of this matters. He doesn't get relief.
And you have to wonder what would be lost on the part of journalists to re-examine that, including re-examining their own role. What is it that they feel they're going to lose? You know, there were many voices at the time calling out corporate media's dereliction of duty. Fair was one of them. But, I mean, it was remarkable.
When Albert Szabo was presiding over the 1995 evidentiary hearing, the Philadelphia Inquirer's headline was, Szabo must go. He's going to let Mumia off because he's so blatantly racist. The headline was, Szabo must go. That was the Post. People know it. the Daily News. People know it. The courts know it. I interviewed Barbara McDermott, a criminal judge in the homicide division. She said Judge Sable was the most racist, sexist, and homophobic judge she'd ever met. Everyone knows. It's not unclear. They all know. They are preserving the system. So Larry Krasner, in an appeal 4 years ago, said if they undid all of Ron Castile, a racist DA's, opinions and judgments, it would question the entire system. So they wanted to narrow it to a class of individuals, smaller class that Mumia was included in. So he's not willing. Who's not willing? They're not willing because the whole system would be called into question. Now, this is a system. You have to remember, this is a system that is built on black bodies. There's an assembly line of black bodies through the Juanita Kidd Injustice Center at 13th and Locust that is paying for the Fraternal Order of Police overtime. So Larry Krasner said it in an Atlantic article. It's the linchpin. The majority white police force of 6,500 police officers, 6,500 retired officers, it is their pensions and it is their overtime to pay their Jersey mortgages. This is not me saying Jersey mortgages. This is the legal director of Kenyatta Johnson's office telling me, oh, yeah, we know why we can't do that. We know why we can't fix the potholes, because the police overtime is out of control. But, you know, they have to pay their Jersey mortgages. Mm-hmm. And really at the last bump, you know, when they need to go for their pension, that's when all the overtime racks up. $50 million of overtime each year. That's the linchpin. That's the dynamic. It's commodifying poor people of color for the service of the white, marginally working class, middle class police officers.
Well, and let me ask you about part of how they sell that narrative, which does have to do with news media. Folks who remember coverage of Mumia's original trial will remember how hard elite media went in on the idea not just of accepting all of the, you know, malfeasance and problems and craziness and around his case, but also there was a big overarching storyline about the idea that anybody who was incarcerated who was deemed political, anybody who was incarcerated who people on the outside were taking an interest in, was to be silenced, right? And so even like a sympathetic piece from Philly's public TV station WHYY last year around protests around Mumia, they led with the idea that the case, quote, pitted supporters, including a long list of national and international celebrities, against police and their supporters who resent the attention, close quote, to the case. So it makes it, media have tried to turn it into not the particular information about this case, which, as you've said, the kind of information that has come out would lead to freedom or to overturning of convictions in other cases. They've made it a kind of litmus test about celebrity interest in incarcerated people, or about incarcerated people as issue rather than as human beings.
Let me just say, that's like Inquirer light.
Yeah.
The real issue here, and I live in Philadelphia, is fear. Fear of the police.
Yeah.
William Marin Mauve knows better. The Pulitzer Prize winning journalists who live in this city, who have covered the city, they know and they are afraid. They are literally afraid. People don't realize that we have a classical radio station, WRTI, in Philadelphia, associated with Temple, for one reason. Because overnight, they switched the switch and took off general public interest programming led by Democracy Now! One day, overnight, changed it to a classical radio station. That's why we have classical radio here in Philadelphia.
Right.
So they do it and they punish us. They punish the producers. They punish the journalists. You know, Lynn Washington can tell you. Everyone knows. That's the thing, is the courts know, the journalists know. They know that this is a scandal, a scheme. They know that the police threats of violence are exactly what keeps people in line. They threaten your job and they threaten your life. Imagine if I had a news van and I painted it Free Mumia and I parked it on the streets of Philadelphia, it would be like a cop magnet to get destroyed, mm-hmm. blown up, torched. All my tires would be slashed. Well, you could just prove it and do it. It would happen. You know, I mean, everyone knows it.
Absolutely.
They are terrified.
Yep.
People here are terrified of the police. And people who have jobs, who have comfortable livings, will not push the envelope. And that includes our editors of our major newspapers and the staff at WHYY. They will not challenge the status quo. They will not air Mumia's voice because there will be direct, both physical and economic penalties.
And let me just spell out for listeners who don't remember, in 1994, NPR had plans to run a series of commentaries from Mumia, who was, after all, a journalist, a former head of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. They canceled that series. They said it was because he was so controversial and such a big story that they then proceeded to do zero coverage for the following year. And then when, as you've just said, then when Democracy Now! Was going to air those commentaries, Philadelphia's KRTI canceled not just Democracy Now!, but all of Pacifica News, saying, quote, with the person in charge saying, quote, "What's good enough for NPR is good enough for me," close quote.
I was in Eileen Weiss's office, the executive director of All Things Considered, when she looked out the window and you could see the Capitol because her NPR office was right there, and she said, "I never thought I would look to the Capitol and be censored. Yesterday, Bob Dole got up on the Senate floor and threatened our entire budget if we dared air this commentary." And she then turned to me and said, "Can you bring me a more acceptable commentator?"
Well, you know, folks don't know what happens behind the scenes, and I'm really appreciating this exposure. You know, folks think that, some folks, I imagine, think that journalists make a decision, who do we want to air, they put that person on, and then they deal with it. And it's not at all how it happens. But I want to bring us, for the final part of our conversation, to the other piece of that, because the efforts to silence, not just Mumia, but the efforts to silence and close off all of the perspectives of people who are incarcerated speak to the power of those perspectives, right? It speaks to why we emphatically need to hear them. And I just want to say, you know, despite the name, Prison Radio is a multimedia production studio, and the whole point is to add the voices of people most impacted by the prison industrial complex to our public conversation. And, you know, Mumia's case is an especially emphatic example of the lengths that powers that be, both legal, political, and media, will go to squelch those voices. But we have work resisting that and countering that, and Prison Radio is part of that. And I just wonder if you'd like to talk a little bit about the project and why you do it.
I first began recording Mumia, and I first heard a scratchy tape of his voice when we were covering the Robert Alton Harris execution in 1992 in California, and we were trying to get people on death row, there were 600 at the time, trying to get their voices into the mix. Look, if you can hear their last words stated by the warden, you can interview them. If we're going to kill them, they have to be part of the story. Mm-hmm. And so I went and tried to get somebody from San Quentin, and I couldn't. But I had heard Mumia. He was in Pennsylvania. I went and I got him. Now, Mumia is especially difficult for the mainstream media to grasp. He's incredibly fluent in the King's English. He's actually fluent in French and German and conversational in Spanish. I mean, he's an incredible intellect, and he was trained in the black newsroom. If America is going to incarcerate 2.3 million, one out of every 100 U.S. citizens is in prison, that needs to be part of the story. And I have dedicated, you know, Prison Radio's work to bringing those voices on every topic into the public debate and dialogue. And we feel like it's critical that those voices are heard. We can't really cover the story, like as a journalist. If you're covering prisons, You really can't cover the story without that first person, without talking to the people that it directly impacts. You know, a lot of times, even my own stations at Pacifica would say, no, we're not going to touch that. Mm-hmm. No, we're not going to talk to homeless people. Mm-hmm. You got to talk to prisoners. You have to give them agency. Because a lot of the prisoners and a lot of the culture of imprisonment tells a deeper story about America. We're not going to get it if we don't go to the prisons and get those voices out. I've been doing it for 30 years. I became a lawyer and an investigator because it's not enough to just broadcast people's voices. We have to bring them home.
Well, I'm going to end on that human note. We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan of Prison Radio. You can find their work online at prisonradio.org. Noelle Hanrahan, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
You're welcome.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Coming up, the latest headlines to Democracy Now! And at the top of the hour, John Grant from This Can't Be Happening, thiscan'tbehappening.net. And several new articles appearing there at their website. You might want to check it out. And John will give us a short report today about the Philadelphia Film Festival that he attended to watch the premiere of A Compassionate Spy, a docudrama based on facts that Dave Lindorf originated in an article. So we've got lots and lots to do. So coming up, headlines of Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations World Food Program's warning of a worsening humanitarian catastrophe after Russian President Vladimir Putin said he would halt the deal granting safe passage of food and fertilizer exports from Ukraine to the rest of the world. The UN says since July, the program's indirectly prevented about 100 million people from falling into extreme poverty. On Monday, Putin said Russia is not abandoning the deal, but would temporarily stop participating in it.
So we are not saying that we are ending our participation in this deal. No, we are saying that we are suspending.
Russia's suspension from the Black Sea Grain Initiative triggered a steep rise in food prices. It came after Russian warships in the port of Sevastopol in Russian-occupied Crimea were attacked by drones Saturday. And as Russia's military accused the British Navy of blowing up the Nord Stream pipelines in September, cutting off supplies of Russian gas to European markets. The United States and South Korea have begun massive war games off the Korean Peninsula. On Monday, the two nations opened Operation Vigilant Storm, a five-day joint drill involving hundreds of warplanes and thousands of troops. North Korea condemned the war games as, quote, rehearsal for invasion and proof of hostile policies by Washington and Seoul, unquote. This comes as the U.S. says North Korea is preparing to carry out its first nuclear weapons test since 2017. Elsewhere in the Pacific region, China slammed plans by the United States to deploy six nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to northern Australia, warning the move threatens to spark a new arms race. This is China's foreign ministry spokesperson, Zhao Lijian.
Such a move by the U.S. and Australia escalates regional tensions, gravely undermines regional peace and stability, and may trigger an arms race in the region. China urges parties concerned to abandon the outdated Cold War zero-sum mentality and narrow geopolitical mindset.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Monday in two cases that aim to end race-conscious admissions decisions by colleges and universities. During nearly 5 hours of arguments, the court's far-right supermajority appeared sympathetic to arguments that the admissions process violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution and the Civil Rights Act. This comes as at least 9 states have already chosen to end consideration of race in university admissions. We'll have more on the Supreme Court and the fight over affirmative action after headlines. In California, prosecutors have filed federal and state charges against the man accused of breaking into House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's home and assaulting her husband, Paul Pelosi, with a hammer. Investigators say 42-year-old David DePapp told them he planned to take Speaker Pelosi hostage and intended to break her kneecaps in order to see her, quote, wheeled into Congress unless she told the truth about, quote, lies told by the Democratic Party, unquote. DePapp faces up to 30 years in prison and a federal assault charge and up to 20 additional years for attempted kidnapping. He also faces a slew of state charges, including attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon. San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins spoke Monday.
What we also have learned is that the defendant brought to the location of the Pelosi residence a second hammer, as well as zip ties, rope, and a roll of tape. What is clear based on the evidence that we have thus far is that this house and the speaker herself were specifically targets of the defendant.
Paul Pelosi remains in intensive care in San Francisco after surgeons repaired his fractured skull and serious injuries to his hands and right arm. In Arizona, Republican gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake drew laughter from a friendly crowd Monday after she joked about the attack on Paul Pelosi. Lake was speaking at a campaign event in Scottsdale.
It is not impossible to protect our kids at school. They act like it is. Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But
Donald Trump Jr. has also mocked the attack on Paul Pelosi. On Sunday, he retweeted a photo of a pair of underwear and a hammer caption, "Got my Paul Pelosi Halloween costume ready." Former President Donald Trump has asked the Supreme Court to block the release of his tax returns ahead of a Wednesday deadline to turn them over to the House Ways and Means Committee. Trump's request for an emergency order came on the first day of opening arguments in a criminal tax fraud trial in New York Supreme Court, where the Trump Organization faces charges of paying top executives millions of dollars worth of off-the-books compensation for 15 years. President Biden's accused oil and gas companies of war profiteering after Russia's invasion of Ukraine led to high energy prices and surging profits for companies like Shell and ExxonMobil. On Monday, Biden said the oil industry should pass profits on to consumers and lower the cost of fuel. If not, he said, they may soon face a higher tax rate on windfall profits.
Give me a break. Enough is enough. Look, I'm a capitalist. You've heard me say this before. I have no problem with corporations turning a fair profit or getting a return on their investment in innovation. But this is remotely what's happening. Oil companies Record profits today are not because they're doing something new or innovative. Their profits are a windfall of war.
Robert Weissman, president of Public Citizen, called a windfall profits tax long overdue, but said it should not be made dependent on more oil and gas drilling. Weissman added, quote, more investment in oil drilling will deepen our dependence on fossil fuels when the worsening climate catastrophe demands we speed the transition away from fossil fuels, he said. The White House says President Joe Biden will attend the COP27 UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, on Friday, November 11th, as part of a larger overseas trip that will also take him to Cambodia and Indonesia. Biden's trip comes as human rights defenders continue to urge the release of all political prisoners in Egypt ahead of the climate summit. Among them is the human rights activist Ala Abdel Fattah, who has been on hunger strike for over 200 days, protesting the horrific conditions he faces in Egypt. In jail. His sister and human rights advocate Mona Saif said on social media her brother is stopping his 100-calorie daily intake and will also begin a water strike starting Sunday, which marks the beginning of COP27. That's November 6th. On Facebook, Saif wrote, quote, this means if no urgent intervention happened, Ala will die before the end of COP27. These are the actions of a man who's had enough after nearly 9 years in arbitrary imprisonment, she said. Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg is not attending COP27, accusing the summit of misleading the public into thinking polluters are committed to combating climate change. She said she will not attend a greenwashing summit. Back in the United States, Border Patrol agents on Monday fired pepper balls at a group of Venezuelan migrants who were leading a protest along the El Paso-Texas-Juarez-Mexico border after they were denied entry into the U.S. and blocked from seeking asylum. This is Yuneria Hernandez, a Venezuelan asylum seeker and protester who witnessed the assault.
They pulled out guns and started shooting. Things shouldn't be like that. We are not animals. We are human beings. We want to go to the United States to work, not to do bad things. We've spent several days here sleeping like animals. The Mexicans are the ones who have helped us with food, clothes, shoes, and blankets.
Earlier this month, the Biden administration started expelling Venezuelan asylum seekers to Mexico under an expansion of the Trump-era pandemic policy, Title 42, which has blocked at least 2 million people from seeking asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border in violation of international law. In news from Britain, police in Kent are being urged to investigate a Sunday attack on a migrant center in the town of Dover as an act of terrorism. The man suspected of throwing at least 2 petrol bombs at the migrant center was found dead shortly after. He reportedly died of suicide. At least 2 people were injured after a fire broke out at the center, which is used to process asylum seekers who've taken on the dangerous journey to cross the English Channel on makeshift boats in the hopes of refuge in the UK. After the attack, about 700 asylum seekers were moved from Dover to the Manston Detention Center in Kent, which advocates say is catastrophically overcrowded. They've since denounced squalid and inhumane conditions at the facility. Meanwhile, immigrant justice and human rights advocates continue to denounce hate speech used by far-right British officials against asylum seekers and migrants. On Monday, British Home Secretary Suella Braverman said England was facing an invasion.
The British people deserve to know which party is serious about stopping the invasion on our southern coast and which party is not.
In Michigan, the former Grand Rapids police officer who killed Patrick Lioia, a 26-year-old Congolese refugee, will face trial on second-degree murder charges. Video of Lioia's killing showed former officer Christopher Scher, a white man, wrestled Lioia to the ground, kicked and hit him, attempted to electrocute him with a taser, and pinned him on his stomach before pulling his pistol and firing a single round into Lioia's head at close range. And in Brazil, thousands of truckers have blockaded roads across Brazil in support of far-right incumbent President Jair Bolsonaro after his narrow defeat to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva in Sunday's presidential runoff election. Bolsonaro has so far refused to concede defeat, has remained silent, raising fears of political violence. Meanwhile, there are signs of a growing rift within the Bolsonaro family. Since the election, the Brazilian First Lady, Michelle Bolsonaro, and her husband have stopped following each other on Instagram. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
So the criminal trial of Donald Trump's family business got underway today, the trial in which his namesake company is charged with engaging in a 15-year multimillion-dollar tax evasion scheme. We're 8 days out from the midterm elections, right? For the de facto leader of the Republican Party, their last president, their all but certain nominee for president in the next election, this is a very awkward time to be dragged into court for a criminal tax evasion trial. But I got to tell you, that's like one egg and a whole carton for him today. I mean, also, simultaneously today, the criminal trial continues of Trump's longtime friend, the chair of his presidential inauguration committee, Tom Barrack. Barrack is charged with acting as a secret agent of a foreign government, trying to influence the U.S. government in order to make money for himself from a foreign power. Also today, jury selection began in a civil trial of Trump and his company over charges that he ordered his security guards to physically attack protesters outside Trump Tower during Trump's campaign. Trump himself had to sit for a deposition in that civil case. That's not to be confused with the deposition he also had to sit for a couple of weeks ago in the defamation case deriving from a woman alleging that he raped her in the mid-90s. Also, today, Trump petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to step in and block the House of Representatives from getting a copy of his tax returns, which he's been desperately trying for years to keep anyone from seeing. Also, Trump is now on his knockoff social media site ranting about how he cannot believe that the Mar-a-Lago classified documents federal criminal case is still going on, even as one of his most loyal lieutenants just pled the fifth before a grand jury considering that case, which, by the way, if you're keeping score at home, brings the number of people in Trump's orbit who've pled the fifth in various recent cases to at least 9, including Trump himself, who spent hours taking the fifth in yet another investigation, the New York Attorney General's investigation of his financial practices. Also, in the Justice Department's ongoing investigation into his efforts to violently overthrow the government on January 6th, the Justice Department is now asking a federal judge to compel Trump's White House counsel and his deputy White House counsel to testify about their conversations with him before that federal grand jury. Also, the seditious conspiracy trial continues of the right-wing pro-Trump paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, who say they came to Washington on January 6th to fight physically to keep Trump in power. At that trial today, there was dramatic testimony from Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn, who told the jury about physically blocking a group of Oath Keepers from getting to Nancy Pelosi's office on January 6th, as he and his colleagues raced to get her staffers to safety. I mean, that's what's going on around the leader of the Republican Party just today, all in a day's work. 8 days before the midterm elections. And all of this, it is not unrelated to the precarious political moment that we are in, right? A system that operates on the rule of law and free and fair elections doesn't work all that well for a party whose leader is in personal legal jeopardy under that system in all these different ways, whose family business is literally on trial right now, as of today, on criminal charges. Even as President Biden was calling the new president-elect, the newspapers in Brazil today carried a statement from Trump advisor Steve Bannon saying there's no possibility that the election result is correct, that Bolsonaro should start a months-long ballot-by-ballot audit of the results, and that whatever he does, he definitely shouldn't leave office. He should stay in office despite the election results. In a live stream last night responding to the election results in Brazil, Steve Bannon said it more bluntly. He said Bolsonaro, quote, can't concede. Can't concede. Why not? Why can't he concede? And why do you care, Steve Bannon? I mean, this is the part that's about us. That's about us and our country and our election next week. Because why do you think it is that this top White House advisor to former President Donald Trump, why do you think it is that he's telling this guy in Brazil, this Trump-like, far-right, buffoonish, unpopular Brazilian president who's just been voted out of office, why is Steve Bannon telling him that he shouldn't admit to the election results. He shouldn't admit that he's been voted out. He cannot concede. Why do you think Bannon is doing that? Do you think that Steve Bannon has some substantive, fact-based beliefs about the integrity of Brazil's elections? Do you think he has some facts that he knows that have made him concerned about how votes are counted in Sao Paulo? Really? Think he has important information about something being wrong with a voting machine in Santa Catarina or some other place in Brazil he's never been to that I'm probably mispronouncing? I mean, why do you think Steve Bannon cares? Why did Trump endorse Bolsonaro and endorse his voter fraud claims even in advance of the election? Why is it that we can be absolutely 100% sure that if Trump were still president instead of Joe Biden, the U.S. government itself would be refusing to acknowledge that Bolsonaro just lost this election? Why? Why do they do this? It is not about Brazil. It is about us. It is about propagating and inculcating into us, or at least inculcating into their supporters, this assertion, this belief, this conviction that elections are bad, that elections are suspect, that elections are for suckers, and anybody who's not a sucker shouldn't believe any election results anywhere. Elections suck. They're a hoax. They're a racket. We shouldn't use them. We know better. And this line of attack, it isn't about any one election. It's not about any particular allegation of something being wrong with some particular election. It's about elections as elections. It's about elections as a category. And you can see it at work in all these different instances, right? That's how you can see it sort of, there's no exceptions here, it's a rule. You can see it at work with Trump and his remoras, like Steve Bannon, insisting that Trumpy guys all around the world shouldn't have to abide by election results. You can see it at home, coming into sharper focus now that we're 8 days out from the next national election. Trump issuing a new endorsement of the Republican candidate who's running against Senator Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire in this election. Trump endorses him now by saying outright that what he likes about the guy is that he is, quote, a strong and proud election denier. So they're embracing that term now. You must be a strong and proud election denier, those are Trump's words, in order to get his endorsement as the de facto leader of the Republican Party. Right? You also see it in that odd footage that's being aired by Fox News over the past few days of Trump calling the Republican Senate candidate in Arizona, this guy Blake Masters, the one who's running against Democratic Senator Mark Kelly. Trump tells him on the call that, hey, Blake Masters, you're doing great, but you need to go harder and louder and more insistent on the issue of election denial. You need to be more out there volunteering all the time saying that elections shouldn't count. And Blake Masters says, oh, yes, I'll do that. I'll go hard on that issue. Why does Trump need that? Why does Trump need that from this Senate candidate in Arizona or this Senate candidate in Nevada? They're not going to be voting on anything related to the 2020 election where Trump lost. Why does Trump want to do this? Why does he want all Republican candidates at every level to insist that elections are for suckers and that election results don't count? The reason he wants to do this is so this idea that elections shouldn't be the way we do things anymore becomes the rallying cry and the operating principle of the Republican Party. And it's working within the Republican Party. I mean, ever since Trump won the Republican nomination for president in 2016, thanks to a Republican primary system he said was rigged and fraudulent, and then he won the general election that year and still said there was fraud in that election, there were millions of illegal votes cast in that election. Right, I mean, even in elections that he wins, he says there was fraud, right? Right through to the 2020 campaign, where even before the election, he claimed that election was fraudulent and that it shouldn't count. Why would you try to undermine faith in an election that you won? Why would you try to undermine faith in elections in other countries that most Americans can't spell? Why would you try to get everybody in your party to say that election results don't count, even when they're not in a position to reverse some sort of election result to put you back in power? It's so that the idea that elections don't count becomes the operating principle of the Republican Party. Say elections are messed up. Insist that you have proof of some kind that you can't show right now, but you have it. Proof that the elections are messed up. on the basis of your false claims that the elections are messed up, then set about actually messing up elections to prove your point. That's the phrase that we're in now, right? There's 67 counties in Pennsylvania. In 50 of those 67 counties, the elections chiefs have left office since the last election because of threats and intimidation. 50 out of the 67 counties in the state. How smoothly do you think elections are going to go in that state this year? In Nevada, there's 17 counties. Election supervisors in 10 of the 17 counties in the state have left already or announced they are leaving. Again, ahead of threats and intimidation from the political right. You may have seen the news over the weekend about this Republican-controlled county in Nevada that is breaking its election system so profoundly. They are swearing in dozens of citizens to be citizen hand counters of their ballots. And that's the only way they want to count. This is a system they are newly inventing that last week took 60 people one full day to count 900 votes poorly. 60 people counting, a full day's work, less than 1,000 votes counted. Here's the Associated Press, quote, two groups of five counters that the AP observed spent about 3 hours each counting 50 ballots. Mismatched tallies led to recounts and occasionally to more recounts. Several of the counters noted how arduous the process was, with one volunteer lamenting, I can't believe it's 2 hours to get through 25 votes. Yeah. If this is how you're going to count them, this is a county with 33,000 registered votes. Took 60 people a full day to get through less than 1,000 votes. They've got 33,000 registered voters in that county. They're getting rid of the election system there, effectively. They're having randos just personally rifle through the ballots and see what they might come up with. To get through 33,000 votes on actual election day, where there's a tight Senate race and other stuff that's really important on the ballot, yeah, it might take them a few months, I don't know, maybe a year to get some kind of tally. Nobody will have much faith in it when they do. It's a system, right? Say the elections are messed up. On the basis of that, actually do mess them up. Then, when the elections are messed up, claim vindication. And show everyone, hey, look, this election thing we used to do, it's just too broken to even try to use that anymore. Wow, what a mess. Why would anybody believe those results? Let's throw the results out. NBC News reports that Paul Pelosi is still in the ICU tonight after the attack, surrounded by family members. He's 82 years old. He reportedly has extensive injuries to multiple body parts, including a fractured skull. Donald Trump Jr. responded to the attack by saying he was working on his Paul Pelosi Halloween costume. And he posted a picture of a hammer and a pair of underwear. Then he posted another picture of a hammer saying it was for open carry in San Francisco. That's the son of former President Trump. Charlie Kirk, who's the head of a big pro-Trump conservative PAC, he said today that some amazing patriot, that was his phrase, amazing patriot should post bail for the attacker, and that person would be a midterm hero if they did it. Carrie Lake is the Republican candidate for governor in Arizona. She got a big laugh, big round of applause on this subject this weekend.
Nancy Pelosi, well, she's got protection when she's in D.C. Apparently her house doesn't have a lot of protection. But
big laugh line for her. So play that tape again. You can see the moderator of the event on the left side of your screen. It looks like he's laughing so hard he might fall over. Oh, it's just hilarious, fracturing his skull with a hammer. There's been a lot of reporting already about the assailant, his perceived beliefs, his writings online, To use a technical term, I would say he seems like a nutball. That's how I would classify him. But his recent writings, you know, for what it's worth, they're all conspiracy theories and rantings that circulate on the far right. Holocaust denial, Jewish bankers, COVID vaccines are a conspiracy, QAnon stuff. He wrote Q is Trump himself. And the real racism is racism against white people. And, you know, I dismiss him as a nutball, and I speak about those things with admitted derision, because, in my opinion, honestly, none of us should feel obliged to play in the sewer of that man's mind. Once you hit someone in the head with a hammer, all of humanity is officially and forever excused from needing to learn about your thoughts and feelings. But if you're a person who has all your faculties, and you know that something like this has happened, if you minimize it, mock it, celebrate it, the attempted murder of the Speaker of the House's husband, what is now formally charged as the attempted kidnapping of the Speaker of the House, well, if that's how you react to knowing this has happened, well, then you're telling us what you want instead of politics. You're telling everybody what you want to be able to do, what you want your side to be able to do to your political opponents, what you enjoy seeing your political opponents subjected to. And that is, in fact, the other option if we're not going to have elections anymore. It's either violence and force, or it's voting. And if it is not voting, then it is going to be violence and force. We're 8 days out from the first national election since the last Republican president, the leader of their party, tried to stay in power by force. And, you know, on Friday, a man pled guilty in federal court to threatening to kill Congressman Eric Swalwell and his staff. Also last week, three people were just found guilty of their part in a militia kidnapping plot targeting the governor of Michigan. Today, Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn testified in the seditious conspiracy trial of the pro-Trump paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, for their role in Trump's effort to have a violent mob of his supporters overthrow the government and keep him in power by force. In power, by force, despite the election results. In power despite the election results and therefore by force. Those are the choices, right? It's either elections or it's force and violence. We are 8 days out. In this election, a clear majority of Republican candidates for congressional and statewide offices say election results should no longer count. They do not believe in election results. Even below that level, in state legislative races, look, clear majorities of Republican candidates in those races in the swing states, they say election results shouldn't count. They don't believe them. We shouldn't use elections anymore. If they do not want us to have elections anymore, don't kid yourself that there is another good option. It is democracy or it's not. And if it's not, it's violence and force. This is the year.
Boy, oh boy, I hate to dump the mic on John Grant today, you know what I mean? That's quite a lead up, huh? Election or violence and force. Well, we got it. Finally, after 2 weeks, I mean, we've got John Grant on. I think he's still there. Are you there, John?
Hey, I'm here.
Yeah, okay, right.
Yeah, I missed 2 weeks. My voice not swirling around out there in Kansas, you know, way out in flyover red state Kansas there. Well, we're sitting here in crazy Pennsylvania, you know. It's like, I just read about Westchester, a town just west of us here, and you know, all the craziness is just going on right over there, you know, outside the city.
Really?
Mastriano and... Anyway, crazy
times.
Well,
what are they doing, John? Yeah, well, I mean, what's
going on? Well, you know, they're this usual stuff. I don't know, you know, there's a story somewhere in here about what's going on in Westchester. My experience with Westchester is... a year, every Saturday, Vets for Peace, we'd go out there and go nose to nose with these guys in motorcycles and right-wing clowns, you know. You know, we were protecting the Quakers. They were against the Iraq War, and they were being harassed by these thugs. And so they wanted us vets to go out there. So just to characterize the absolute stupid lunacy of it, these clowns were out there. And one day, I was the first day with my buddy, Tom, and he's talking to this guy. And I interjected and said something right next to him, you know, and he looks at me and he goes, "Fuck you." And I said, "Whoa, okay, you're right to my face." And I said, "No, fuck you," I said, you know. And he said, "Fuck you twice." And I said, "No, fuck you three times and I'm ready to go up to 15, you know. And the guy cracked up. He started laughing.
There you go. There you go.
You know, if, I mean, the absurdity of all this is what's really noteworthy. It's like,
I think you're as
lethal a lot of it may be, you know. I mean, you look at this guy that attacked Mr. Pelosi. You know, you wonder.
I know.
You know, you think of revolutions and civil wars and death squads and all this kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
And we hear all these horrors that the right wing is churning up death squads and, God, they're coming to get us, poor liberals, you know, and all this. And this is what it is? You know, it's like, you know, some, you know, Tucker Carlson went on for like a half an hour saying this guy was an illegal alien and a homeless man.
Well,
I don't know where he got. Well, I
now
beg
they're...
your pardon, Tuckums, as Joy Reid calls him, Tuckums. What the fuck are you talking about? And so here, this guy. Yeah, I mean, think of like, you know, efficient hitmen and assassins and all this kind of stuff, you know, really hardball, you know, engaged psychopaths that really, you know how to do this, the wet work, as they call it, you know. And you get this guy who breaks in and tells Mr. Pelosi, who is a very smart man, you know, that, hey, sit down. We're waiting for Nancy. Well, Nancy's in Washington. She won't be here for 2 or 3 days. Well, you know. And then he says, he lets Mr. Pelosi, this is this crack terrorist, right, lets Mr. Pelosi go to the bathroom with his cell phone. You know, closes the door and calls 911. Hey, I'm the husband of the Speaker of the House, the third in line for the presidency, and a man with a hammer has just attacked me. Come and get me. Well, the cops get there, and they see these two guys fighting over a hammer, and they go like, what? What is going on here? And then when he hits Mr. Pelosi with the hammer, they engage with him and throw him down and arrest him. You know, it's like, wow, this is the movement that we're afraid of, you know? You know, I don't want to be too glib about it, but it's, you know, incredible to me, especially at the day that Jair Bolsonaro lost in Brazil, making Brazil a huge country, of course, the third democratic country in South America and Central America that has gone left. 6 out of 7 of them have gone left. I don't know what's left, but Colombia has a left-wing government now. You know, it's like, why? You know, why? What's going on here? And here we are, and apparently Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil hasn't said boo or peep about the threats that he's going to take over, you know, the fraudulent election, all this. Apparently the reasonable right-wingers in Brazil realize that this vote was an anti-Bolsonaro vote. People are sick and tired of the way they've really fucked Brazil in the last 4 years because, you know, Lula and his replacement, you know, they weren't perfect, but, you know, they were trying to do important things for Brazil, to turn it into a first world country, et cetera, et cetera. And this guy has just taken it backwards. you know, with climate change and the Amazon and yada yada. And so the Brazilians are delighted to have Lula back. And so it seems that Bolsonaro, for the moment, has run out of gas, that he's not going to say, you know, we want an insurrection here like Trump did, modeled on Trump. Well, it'll be interesting the next few days what happens, but it's really big news out of Latin America.
Yeah, well, Trump is more like, I think, on this goddamn social media, you know. Someone's intercepted. Trump's saying, don't leave the presidential mansion. It's almost like to Bolsonaro.
Well, Trump, exactly.
I mean, talk about a chicken shit way of fighting. I mean, he is the orange Jesus. That is how he's been described by people, his own party, to Liz Cheney in some basement on January 6th. Listen to me. January 6th, here's Liz Cheney, a conservative I do not like, but, you know, hey, I think she's being honest. She said at the American Enterprise Institute, she was describing the night of the January 6th mob attack on the Capitol, and she was in a basement. She didn't say exactly. She was in some basement, some bunker, with these other Republicans, and they had to sign these papers certifying the election, okay, the Electoral College, okay. And they all were lining up, and this one guy came up, and he wasn't going to sign it, of course. And he says, what we have to do for the orange Jesus. What must we do now for the orange Jesus? I mean, that's a Republican talking to Liz Cheney. So I can see why she is fired up about January 6th. I mean, you know.
Right.
But the orange Jesus is coaching other leaders like Bolsonaro. And say, I think, you know, this was my big thing. Historically, I knew that him attacking the Capitol building was probably the dumbest act in the world. But look who he had working for him. Look who he had working for him.
Exactly.
These guys who thought they were getting orders on Twitter directly from the president as orders from the commander-in-chief to attack the Capitol building. If they really wanted to do it, they would have had a Waco-type situation at the White House.
Right.
You know, seize the thing.
Well, it's like Son of Sam got his orders from a dog, you know. It's like he can get orders from anybody, you know, anything, you know, like, Christ.
And then the orange Jesus, his son gets on Twitter yesterday whatever, Truth Social, and I saw the message. And it's a picture of a ball peen hammer laying on a piece of underwear, okay? Now, that was his These are really sick.
Well,
people.
I think it was Don Jr. and somebody else. Oh, Vance, J.T. Vance, I believe. Maybe some of those clowns. They fabricated this story. You know, like Tucker Carlson has him as a homeless alien, you know, or he's not a citizen. I think he's a citizen. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. But anyway, the other story they fabricated was that this is, of course, San Francisco, right? You know, gay San Francisco.
Yeah, Mr.
Pelosi was engaged with a male prostitute in his BVDs. You know, get that image out, you know, and we're going like, what, you know, a guy hits him with a hammer, and now suddenly, you know, he's a male prostitute, you know, absolutely out of the blue, you know, where that comes from, except that San Francisco is noted for, you know, homosexuals, it's a fact of life,
well,
like Key West.
Harvey, well, not only, the extreme violence, I mean, I saw the African-American sister who is the prosecutor prosecuting this thing. I saw her do the press briefing yesterday in San Francisco, and she, in not so many words, reminded everybody in the world about, you know, political violence in San Francisco is on its way back, and she didn't say it, but all of you listeners, just go watch the movie Milk with Sean Penn, you know?
Absolutely.
It's about, you know, because Dan Alexander, a lot of us old people like John and I remember very clearly Dan Alexander going in, killing the mayor with a gun.
No, it was Alexander. It was something else, wasn't it? Dan, I don't know. I know you mean.
I'll look it up. But this guy, he was a city supervisor.
Yeah, and it was like the Twinkie. Wasn't it the Twinkie defense that he had just eaten a lot of sugar and he just lost it?
I'll look it up here real quick, but I'll tell you one thing I remember. He did less than 5 years in prison, killing two people at City Hall.
Well, then he killed himself, Mike. He killed himself. He eventually killed himself. Really? I mean, he couldn't stand it. He fucking killed himself.
I believe you. I'm not refuting that. I'm just saying that this was how sick of that was like an omen. But this prosecutor, female prosecutor, she's talking about how we're not strangers to this kind of stuff. We're gonna prosecute him with everything we got. Federal charges and all that.
This guy's gonna be hung. You're from the nearest rafter, you know. Not literally, of course.
He'll be lucky to get life withdrawal. He'll be lucky to get life withdrawal.
Yeah, I mean, bad timing, pal, if you're going to make a stumble bum attack on the husband of the third in line for the presidency, you better do a better job next time. You know what I mean?
He's not going to get it next time.
Right, of course. All of his comrades, you know.
Yeah, is there a line? In the previous hour, at the very tail end, I was playing, and I don't, I get sort of tired of Rachel Maddow's sometimes histrionics, but she laid out for 18 minutes before you came on.
Amen.
One crazy shit after another as we're going in 8 days out to the election. I mean, it was just everything from how many lawsuits and criminal charges and investigations are surrounding Trump, you know, and all his accountant and everybody. She systematically went down, boom, boom, boom. All these. Then she went, and you know, I tell you, when I ran for House of Representatives in 2016, one of the first things I dropped. I hate to admit it. I'll admit it on air because it was in the newspaper. I thought I was upset because the county clerk had got $60,000 and bought these goddamn voting machines. And I shot my big mouth off like an idiot and said, why can't we go back to hand counting ballots humans, you know? Because I was upset over the $60,000, you know? Of course, the newspaper took it wrong. And the editor of the paper later told me, he says, I do not want to spend a day or two days at the courthouse watching these people count pieces of paper.
Right.
I want to get the results. And I thought about that, you know. But now
a rather conservative position you took. You know, let's keep it the way we've always had it.
That's not radical.
It's not even liberal. That's just conservative. Let's do it the way. You thought about it and you say, well, maybe we do need to make some.
I used the machines at that time. I trust them. But in Arizona, I think Rachel said it was Arizona or something. In this 18-minute diatribe.
Right.
She pointed out that they had like 60 people volunteering to count votes. I think it was Arizona.
Right.
You can play it back, listeners, and tell me I'm wrong or whatever.
Well, they had that phony recount in Arizona.
I know. There's all this ferment is boiling under the surface.
Right.
And these people took them 2 hours. To argue over 25 votes, and they had they had 33,000 votes to people voting, vote ballots to count, and you got people in there arguing over it'll take weeks, months, you know, to count that many votes by hand with a bunch of quarrelsome people, you know, and that, I think she's got a point. We have people in camouflage, dressed up as some you know, some, I don't know what you call them, some crazy bastards like that you saw at the Capitol mob attack, dressed up watching the ballot boxes, doing surveillance on the ballot boxes.
Oh, I saw them. Yeah, I saw them in the parking lot with masks and bulletproof vests and God knows what else. You know, I mean, again, to me, it's like a clown show. And you know it, what it reminds me of? Who was it yesterday reminded me of? The movie Joker, you know, the Joker guy. You know, I don't know, some of these right-wing lunatics, you know, remind me of that film, you know, and the, I don't know if you saw The Joker, did you?
Yeah, I saw it, of course, yeah.
Very good, you know, and kind of Dostoevsky in a way, but yeah, it's just crazy. It's you know, it's in the air. You know, we're all unhappy. You know, we're the most individualistic humans on Earth, in the history of Earth. You know, that you are an individual, a rugged individual, or you're a feminized individual. I don't know, whatever kind of individual you're an American. You're an individual. You have a right to your own being and your own identity and all that. Well, that goes up against reality and, you know, the new, you know, robber barons and the internet and all this. You know, they have different ideas about your individuality. They see you as a blip in some goddamn algorithm or something. You know, it's a formula on the blackboard that's 6 yards long. You know, that's, you know, the way the individual is seen now by these, especially these right-wing political operatives. To me, what it's doing is it's making Harry Frankfurt, the former chairman of the philosophy department at Harvard, in his book called On Bullshit, in which he says the most salient feature of American culture is there's so much bullshit. And he wrote that 12 years ago. You know, well, since then, you know, Donald Trump and company, you know, have just assumed the reality of that topic sentence and said, well, hey, if bullshit is really loose, let's go for it. You know, we're not even making any, you know, any guise here that this is reality. We're just throwing it out there. And, you know, we have the internet to induce this magic belief into people's minds. And, you know, here we are now. We're trying to figure it all out. And my feeling is that because of the internet and because of our wars, especially Iraq, you know, I always feel that sort of existentially and humanly, when you go to war with some people that ended up like going to war with ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Anbar province and all this kind of stuff, that by going to war intimately with certain elements, you assume some of their characteristics. You just have to. It's war, you know. And so Iraq and Afghanistan, the whole post 9/11 war has really militarized the country more than it even was before. And so and then you look at Latin America, where, you know, domestic violence is not a new issue. Here it's a new issue kind of thing, where in Latin America, politics has always been equated with a kind of war. And so now, again, the politics or the cycle in Latin America now is going back to the left, whereas the United States is, with the MAGA people and all that, they're desperately trying to hold on to this past, you know, this past of exploitation, and you know, we were the top dog, you know, white men and all this. And well, you know, it's a struggle, and you know, it's going to continue, but so far the lunatics are the ones that are prevailing here. And you know, it's just you know, it's an interesting time to live in, frankly, is the way I look at it.
Yeah it is it's very interesting. And in some cases, dangerous in ways you can't really predict. I mean, almost, you know, like this guy with the ball-peen hammer, you know. And this guy obviously is going to use the court. He's going to try to use the court as a place to shoot his mouth off. You know what I mean? He holds this with the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers. That's one way of putting it. Mentally walking wounded. Mentally wounded walking.
Mr. Salter here, please, I got to go take a pee. Do you mind if I go to the bathroom? Oh, sure, go ahead. Just lock the door, too. Keep the privacy in there. And, go ahead. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah, I'll stay out here and watch. We'll wait for Nancy. You know? I'm going late. Is this the best you can do?
Well, I wouldn't issue challenges like that over the air. There's so many nuts out there. Right. Look at that one guy. He came in and attacked an FBI office.
Didn't he have a hammer?
I think he had something like that. He had a gun. We know that.
He had a gun. This guy didn't have a gun,
He got into a running shootout on the highway with the cop that chased him down. It's just like suicide by cop, you know what I mean? These people, I hate to even use those two words, these people. But, I mean, it's really the only thing it's one guy, he's a vet like you. It's called the Task Force Butler. It's a website. Just type it in, taskforcebutler.org. He's a vet, and he's appearing on various shows. And he's organized other veterans to identify these people, these crazy people. He's a straight up anti-fascist, but he doesn't think street violence is the worst thing that you can get engaged in. It's all about identifying what people have a proclivity in. He's a very interesting guy, and I've watched
him. Now, what is the Butler reference? Would it be Smedley Butler, by any chance?
Smedley. It is Smedley. It's right there, a big picture of Smedley. Okay. The article I printed in this Comfort magazine that you wrote about Smedley Butler.
There you go.
You were on it. You're on it. And
Followed Smedley Butler for over a decade here. Yeah, it's he 1933. Thanks to Smedley Butler, a two-star Marine general who won two Congressional Medals of Honor and was a Quaker, raised a Quaker. He was instrumental in blocking a coup insurrection attempt, if you will, in 1933 that was deep sixed and you never heard about in history courses, like a lot of things, you know. He was, because a two-star general, and it was started by the coup attempt, if you will. It was kind of a stumble bump thing, but a broker connected to some money bags on Wall Street. You know, FDR was seen as the traitor to his money bags class. So all these Wall Street guys sent this broker and other people over to Europe to study the black shirts, the brown shirts, and the silver shirts in Britain. And because they were a lot of them, disgruntled World War I vets. Well, the American Legion in America had 500,000 many disgruntled World War I vets. And in fact, the U.S. Army military at the time didn't have 500,000 people. It was like, 130,000 or something like that. I don't know exact figure. So that the idea was to model on the black shirts, the brown shirts, and silver shirts, and get a man on a white horse, a general, to be a fascist leader, And they chose Smedley Butler, who was very popular with his troops. Alas, they screwed up. They should have picked Douglas MacArthur, who was a true fascist, and in fact, you know, destroyed the Bonus March. You know, he blew it up and burned it down and killed a couple people. And Smedley Butler, of course, spoke pro-Bonus March in the Washington thing and the Bonus March in 1933 again. So they picked the wrong guy, and he got wind of it. They were going to humiliate the president for being a cripple, which was taboo at the time, and he was going to be weak, you know, and a cripple, and America needed a strong military person. So they were going to slip this man on a white horse into a new a cabinet-level position called the Secretary of General Purposes or something like that. And they were going to appoint, they were going to intimidate him, get to appoint this guy, the man on the white horse, and he would eventually overwhelm the president, the weak, wheelchair-bound president, and, you know, have America, would have an authoritarian leader. Well, It didn't work, and Smedley, with a reporter from the Philadelphia Record, started secretly assembling information about it all, and he turned it over to the House Un-American Activities Committee, which, of course, eventually became an anti-communist thing, but at the time, this was an investigation against the right wing. And they did a full investigation, and they found, that there was cause, that these people had really done this stuff. And at that point, I think FDR, you know, having all that information, got word to these Wall Street Daddy Warbucks and said, listen, you sons of bitches, I got you by the you-know-what. I have you for treason. And if I hear a peep out of you, I'm going to pursue treason charges against you. And that was the end of it. We never heard again about it. So Smedley's the man. He's the man of the hour, I think. It'd make a great film. I've written some scenes from it, from a film. So it's really an important story that, you know, somebody probably should make the film. I should get off my ass.
Well, it might be something else you can do. Here it is, taskforcebutler.org.
Mm-hmm. I'll look it up.
Right here, it says, it opens up with Smedley, a black and white picture of Smedley, and his, I think they call him Dress Blues, he's Marine.
Right.
And here's a quote. My one hobby is maintaining a democracy. If you get 500,000 soldiers advocating anything smelling of fascism, I'm going to get 500,000 more and lick the hell out of you. That was 1934.
There you go. That's our man Smedley.
Butler said that. And it says, Task Force Butler's mission is to engage veterans in the hobby of maintaining a democracy. That's Smedley.
I like that hobby.
You could support our work, help us train veterans to fight the rise of extremism in the United States of America. And
I'm
going to
dig
veteran?
Into this. Thanks for hitting me on.
I want to let the listeners know. Are you a U.S. military veteran who is interested in joining Task Force Butler? And it's he was bragging, the guy who did this was bragging that he got his 501(c) for the Task Force Butler Institute, and he puts it all up on front right here. But you really have to be a veteran to join in on this. It's called an interest form. I didn't join it. I asked to do research as a journalist on Project Blacklisted. That's the only project listed on this Task Force Butler.org. It's the case for holding legally accountable the neo-Nazi terrorist, racketeering gang, Patriot Front, for conspiracy to commit violence hate crimes against the people of Philadelphia, Coeur d'Alene, and Boston. So you're hometown. You're on ground zero.
The Vets for Peace chapter in Boston is called the Smedley Butler chapter. Yeah, Smedley's he's a big deal amongst Veterans for Peace. A lot of times his story is simplified and glorified on the left because, as I point out in the essay that you ran in your paper, that. Smedley was a figure of his times, and when he was the proconsul, military proconsul of Haiti, he was a flaming racist, and he supported, used his military Marines to literally support slavery on the road that I wrote about. So Smedley has a mixed bag kind of history, but when it comes down to the crunch and democracy, there was no question.
No.
He was the man. He was the man, and he still is the man. Life is complicated. Yes, many of us white people, we do have racism in our past. And I think with identity politics, we need to grow up a little bit and accept some of that. You know, that, yes, we're human beings, we're flawed, and, that's it. But it's what we're doing now. It's not what we did 40 years ago, I might have used some unfortunate word in some unexplained context, and gives a rat fuck? I'm talking about what we're doing right now, what we need to do right now, and we need to get this country structured together so at least we can, get off our dead asses and fix things that need to be fixed, Anyway, that's my policy position.
these guys have formed a task force of researchers and activists
who have
worked tirelessly to protect frequently marginalized communities throughout the United States. They're focusing on this one group, Patriot Front. He calls he points out that it's a legal definition of a criminal gang. And one thing they point out in your hometown, Philadelphia, was July 2nd or 3rd, 2021, assault on a black man. This street gang, Patriot Front, did in Philadelphia, and then they did another racist attack in Boston on July 2nd, 2022, almost a year later, premeditated racist assault on a black man. And then on June 11th, I know about this, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, 11th June, they attacked, they formed up and were targeting a pride festival that was going on in that town. So these guys are actually trying to do some serious on-the-ground work. It's taskforcebutler.org.
I'm going to immediately after the show look it up.
It's reserved for veterans. Only veterans can really be part of the task force. But I asked for a report as a journalist, and I'm waiting for it.
They should allow associate members the way Vets for Peace does. You don't want to be too anal about this veterans thing.
Well, I'm not going to tell them what to do. I'm just very fascinated in their work, and I think the more airtime I can give them, give this one guy who's leading it. I think he's an Iraq war vet or Afghanistan. He admits he's got PTSD. He talks
quite
openly. I'm looking for it right now. It's not listed on the website.
I'll look it up.
He's popped up. Where did I see him? It was on. Well, I think Democracy Now! Had him on just last week. He was one on there. So it's a very unique development and holding these people legally accountable. And he's talking only legally accountable. He's not street fighting's out. He, but he, He
I agree. I don't think demonstrations in the street or vigils of 14 people on the corner, I don't think that's doing us any good. I've said that for years about vigils. You know, I think the vigils actually are shooting ourselves in the foot because, I have a friend, a very, very good friend of mine who does this.
Right.
You know, he's Catholic kind of thing, and it's a very spiritual thing. And, you'll get 14 people on the corner, they do anti-drone thing at Willow Grove. But my feeling is, when people going about their business, going to the mall, doing whatever the hell they do in this culture, they're in their nice cars and their air conditioning is on, and they see 14 people over there, with signs, and they don't even necessarily know what the hell the demonstration's about. All they do is they know those people are losers and they're impotent. You know what I mean? That it's something people see it as sort of pathetic and quaint and silly to demonstrate like this, especially in small, 14, 15 people kind of thing. Anyway, yeah. That's my question. I don't have all the answers, but I wonder whether it's actually defeating your purpose by emphasizing what the left, especially the anti-war left, lacks, the key instrumental thing they lack, which is power. And so this, makes it quite evident. Oh, look at these clowns over here. I don't have all the answers on that, but I do have this very strong feeling when I see these things. And sometimes I participate in them because they're old friends, and it's...
Sure, of course, of course.
Yeah, you know how it is.
But, well, I think people are quickly learning that in this country that maybe the only effective way of really shocking the system back into a reality is through voting. I hate to say it, but I mean,
exactly.
I'm back in the old.
Well, I've come to the same position. Absolutely, yeah.
And getting people.
Well,
it's sort of popular.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please. Yeah.
The more you get, the more people in this country that come out to vote. We have to remember, it was only a few years ago, 40% of the people didn't even bother to vote. They didn't even bother to vote. They weren't even really members of any party or anything.
Right.
And that's huge. I know here in Kansas it's a little bit less than that, but still, it's a huge body of people who just don't vote and are not even declared a party, of what affiliation that they're with. So, this thing in Kansas that happened over abortion, that was a shock to everybody, not just in the state of Kansas, but really, it ricocheted the news.
There's a shot across the bow, that's for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's still important.
20% of the people who voted on, this is on a constitutional amendment, to basically let the state legislature be doctors. Okay. And they're going to be.
And this is, of all places, Kansas, dead center in the country. And, of course, you have a lot of deep knowledge on all this because you obviously went through that struggle, so.
Yeah,
that's a very important juncture. Yeah.
Well, here's something that was shocked. I was going through the vote tallies and stuff, and a smartass, a nerd at CNN, and actually it was a team of nerds at CNN.
Oh my God, a team of nerds!
Team of nerds, worst thing. I got to tell you, I'm beginning to gain respect for nerds, with the exception of Elon Musk. But
exactly. He's transcended nerddom to become an asshole, but that's okay.
Yeah, let me shoot this number at you. 20% of the ballots that were cast in this historic primary. This is a primary. This is not even the midterm election. This is just last month, August 8th. 20% of all the ballots. 20% of all the ballots, they didn't even vote for any human candidate. They just voted to stop that amendment. 20% of all the ballots.
Wow,
cast.
Now what does that tell you?
Nobody voted for a human. They just turned. And I'll tell you what, the day I went in with my son Tristan, I got the paper ballot, and I'm looking at it, and I go, yeah, I know all these people. Half of them are people I don't like. You know, they're crazies. They're already elected in our county government. Why, you know, why do I want to vote for them again? They're going to win it. They're going to win anyhow. And I turned the ballot over. Now, Tristan's in a booth just next door to me, right next to me.
Uh-huh.
And I turned the ballot over. Now, these ladies, these are nice old ladies at the election board.
Okay? Uh-huh. Okay.
And they still like me, okay? And I turned the ballot over, and there it is. There's the amendment proposal to change to ban abortion. And I turned to Tristan, I said, and he's looking for it too, and I said, it's on the other side of the ballot. And this woman, a Republican representative, she said, you can't do that. You can't do that. You can't do that. I said,
can't do what?
I can't turn the ballot over and tell my son where is the amendment at. Because it was hard to find. They buried it. It was hard to find. And they did that on purpose. They did that on purpose. They first in a primary. And they were sneaky son of a bitches, the Republicans in Topeka.
Well, it's not the first time. You know, in Florida, you remember all those sneaky ballots where all those Jews in some old folks' home, like hundreds of them, voted for Patrick Buchanan, you know, like an anti-Semite, you know, like, no, I don't think they were voting. They just couldn't figure out the goddamn ballot. And that was shown,
right?
You know, and what the election, the primary, the election in Florida in 2000 was like 300 votes characterized who won that election. That turned out to be such a corrupt thing with the Supreme Court. Well, that's because in this case, you know, these old Jewish ladies and they were voting for Patrick Buchanan, which no, they were not voting for Patrick Buchanan. You know, come on, give me a fucking break. But that, you know, 2000. Frankly, I mean, look at American history here. How American history would have been changed if I think justly, you know, Al Gore would have been elected president. I'm not a Gore fan, but you know, I voted for him. And you know, if he legitimately won that election, which arguably he did, you know, if all these other issues had been ironed out, think of the Iraq War. Would the Iraq War ever have happened? I don't know. It might, probably not. You know, a completely alternative history. I guess you can waste your time thinking about that stuff, but...
I mean, not only Iraq and Afghanistan, but I mean, just think his first book he came out with was An Inconvenient Truth after he lost the election, and it was about climate change. I think we would be further along on lead the world, you know, and fighting it. And it's a sad thing, but 20% of all of plus. It was in the state of Kansas, it was really a tidal wave of new people coming in, registering to vote.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
and this is over a goddamn primary. This is a primary.
Right.
I mean, this is not
that's why we don't know what's going to happen in the midterm coming in, what, a week away. There's now the big, there was this guy, I don't know who he was, I've never seen before, on MSNBC talking to Joy Reid. And they were talking about these polls now, these very artful, cynical, corrupt polls that are coming out from the Republicans, push polls. I don't know, they have names for them. I don't know, this whole academic science of mind-fucking and polls that, you know, that what they're doing is they're pushing polls that suggest that, well, the Republicans at the last minute are having a surge, your favorite word, surge,
you know, and if you're
a Democrat or a liberal, you're a loser, you might as well stay home with your finger up your ass, you know, it's like, wait a minute here, you know, and this guy was outraged. He said, you know, I'm glad you're doing a story on it, Joy Reid, but it should have been done months ago because, you know, this is the game they're playing with polls.
Yeah.
And the media, right. Our liberal media, trip over themselves reading polls. They give them too much credence. And he's saying that they're mind-fucking the whole populace here with these polls and saying, you know, oh, the Republicans are surging. Whereas in your case, what you're saying, what happened with the vote in you know, that vote in Kansas, the surge was really on the left, you know.
No, it's even bigger. And, it was the left because,
yeah.
Remember, I'm going to say it again, 20% of all the
yeah,
ballots.
Right.
They didn't vote for any candidates of either party.
Right.
They did not
right.
vote for candidates of either party. We got 10 minutes, let's shift the mute.
Dear young people,
don't vote.
Don't vote.
Everything's fine the way it is.
Trump, that was us.
He's our guy.
Tax cuts for the rich? Hell yeah, I'm rich as fuck.
Climate change? That's a you problem. I'll be dead soon.
Sure, school shootings are sad.
But I haven't been in a school for 50 years. I can't keep track of which lives matter.
Sure, you don't like it. So, you'll like some meme on Instagram.
If the weather is nice, maybe you could go to one of those little marches.
You might even share this video on Facebook.
But you won't vote.
You young people never do.
But I do. I do.
I do. Midterms. Primaries.
Every single election.
We'll be there, but you won't.
Because we're a generation of doers.
Not whiners.
And we're doing great.
Wow. No, I like that. Wow, that's amazing. That has some real backspin to it. Yeah, wow. You know, people got to think when they hear an ad like that, you know, like... Well, you know, I've come to the conclusion that identity politics is destructive. We're destroying ourselves on the left by attacking each other. We need to be pure on this identity group, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of, you know, the idea of lifting all boats, you know, which of course is the S word, you know, pragmatic socialism, you know, which of course. Is real in America, whether people recognize it or not. There's so many isms in this melange that is the United States of America, you know, it's hard to keep track of. But, you know, that it's coming to me, I realize more and more that the idea of the anti-war peace movement that I got into as a veteran, that you're sort of in a righteous position saying, you know, that you're not involved in the problem because they're the evil problem, the military and all that. Whereas I think because I was in the military and, you know, I was complicit in a lot of things, I can't detach myself from this reality of war and all this kind of other stuff. So you have a different position. And, you know, you can't take a righteous position and say, well, it's all evil and we just have to do away with it. You can't because you're corrupted by it. You're complicit in it. And so to me, what that's done for me is reinforced, as you were suggesting, I think, you know, the only way to change things in this culture, it's not perfect, is electoral politics. You know, as messy as that is, the politics being, you know, the art of the possible, I think some people call it. It's not perfection. It's not ideal. It's not righteous. It's just the best that you can come up with in a world that demands compromise, because there's so goddamn many of us. As Sartre says, hell is other people. You know, we just have to live with them. And, you know, so that kind of world, so if you can somehow generate a structure with it that has a respected system of electoral shifting and change, you're ahead of the game. And, of course, nowadays, Republicans know that, you know, this MAGA idea and all these hard right things that are not going to be sustainable in a democratic context because, you know, most people are, you know, in the granular bottom, you know, and they want some bottom up sort of structures in government to protect them from this and that, you know. So I don't know. I think many people on the left need to be guided very gently into accepting the idea that electoral politics is not the end of the world. You know, and I have so many friends that I argued the last election, come on, get your ass out there and vote for Joe Biden. I know he stinks, but just
You can vote for other people down ballot if you don't like Biden.
Well, that's down ballot, but if you vote for Tulsi Gabbard in 2024, who's now grooming herself, I believe, to be an alternative Green Party candidate or something to suck votes, you know, from the Democrats and then elect the Republican.
Tulsi
Gabbard, for Christ's sakes, you know, God, you know.
Yeah, right, right. Well, look, here's another critical lesson from the August 8th primary in Kansas. The 20%, I'm sure, of the people who did not vote for any human candidate on that ballot, they only voted on that one issue.
They voted
for
an idea. Yeah, exactly.
An idea of keeping a woman's autonomy about her body. Okay, I want to say this quite clearly. That 20%, I'm sure, was composed of a lot of kids. Now, I shouldn't call them kids. They're young men and women. Young men and women, because when the news broke about this election, about that primary, that night, everywhere in Overland Park, in Lawrence, Kansas, in Emporia, out in the country, in the sticks, there was these young pictures of these kids with these strange haircuts and colored hair, jumping up and down, because they were the ones
pink and green hair, some of them, yeah.
Yeah, can you hear me? Yeah. It was the strangest thing I thought. I thought, these are the kids. These are the young people, young men and women, who really spearheaded this whole thing. They went door to door. They did all these good things. Can you hear me?
Right. Yeah,
it was incredible. So, well, we're 3 minutes out, and I don't know if we're going to have time to talk movies.
Okay, what movie you want to talk about?
Well, I didn't. I was waiting to see what you were watching lately. But you've only got a minute.
Oh,
what are you watching?
Let me see. God, I'm trying to remember here. I watch a lot of movies, you know. And
I know.
What have I seen that's good? I don't know. Let me think. Okay. Well, I still go back to The Counselor. The Counselor is... To me, Cormac McCarthy wrote it, and Ridley Scott directed it, and it's about a lawyer, rich lawyer, who's trying to do a drug deal and getting. Oh, it's just the world we live in. To me, I've seen it three times, and it gets better every time. It's a horrific film, really. It's subtle, but it's horrific.
It is.
You know?
Yeah, you really got to warn the listeners.
I don't know why that one stuck so much with me, but I really liked it. And also, I got to know Ridley Scott. I watched The Duel with Matt Damon as a medieval illiterate lord, you know.
And
I thought, kind of imagining yourself into this honor duel in the 14th century or whatever the hell it was, just immersing yourself for 2 hours in this guy's conundrum, you're going like, wow. Because I think, frankly, when this talk about ideas and the idea of, changing times and, Hegel's idea of thesis, antithesis, synthesis, as I've said, I think, it's kind of glib, but I think we're going through a major synthesis of the nation state, which is ebbing, and of course before the nation state there was medieval feudalism. And I think some of the tenets of medieval feudalism are seeping back into our new internet world, where the nation state's ebbing, and you know, another power centers like Elon Musk and other whack jobs with billions and billions of dollars, you know, are changing the structures of power that we, as human beings, all have to engage with. You know, so history is evolving, and we have to recognize that we are, each of us individuals in America, we're all complicit and caught up in the swirl of history. There's no way out. You can't just divorce yourself and say, I'm righteous, and I know. We're in it together. On that note,
John Grant.